Yeah, so it's maybe you know, probably I started this whole series on the Four Noble Truths, and last week I was trying to finish the third truth, but that didn't happen. So tonight the continuation of that. So I had already discussed the other three Noble Truths earlier before I left. But do you refresh again this just to name them, the first truth is there is suffering or unsatisfactoriness. So dukkha is the Pali word, which is maybe a best translation is unsatisfactoriness. And then the second one is that there is a cause for this unsatisfactoriness, which is craving. And then the third truth is that there is the end of this unsatisfactoriness, the awakening. And then truth is that there is a path leading to the end of unsatisfactoriness, the Noble Eightfold Path. And so this third truth that I'd like to discuss a bit more today is basically the end goal of the Buddhist path. So end goal is to end suffering, basically, to end this unsatisfactoriness of life, to awaken, to get liberated, or to. And last time I talked a little bit about how do we get there. I described this gradual sloping ocean floor. You might not even really notice that we're slowly going deeper and deeper and deeper, gradually kind of leading ourselves towards this eightfold, through this eightfold path that we're walking, that I described in one of these other talks. By the way, the good news is that I finally uploaded it into the website, so there's resources, there's a little menu item with downloads. So when we gradually kind of walk the eightfold path, walk down this ocean floor, we start to enjoy a more happy and content life. And just a little bit less dukkha with every step we take. And then what I said last time, also liberation then causes this higher quality samsara. So we start to enjoy the higher quality samsara. And so when we do that, maybe you know that at some point the ocean floor hits the reef in some parts of the world, and then there's this steep drop off. And that can kind of be a symbol for awakening, kind of like a steep drop off into this insight that might happen into the nature of reality. So I want to talk about you know this steep drop off, what happens. That might be kind of you know interesting and exciting to hear for some of us, and for others, you know, it might be less interesting and doesn't really resonate as much. So I just wanted to make that because you know it might be good to know what information you have. Is this something you're curious about, or is it something like I'm not sure about this part of Buddhism, maybe a more high quality samsara type, an awakening type. One doesn't have to exclude the other. You know, you could go for high quality samsara and then at some point you end up in awakening, or you could aim for awakening and then gradually work, it just happens that higher quality samsara is happening.
What is samsara?
Yeah, samsara is the endless cycle of birth and death. And so it's endless kind of unsatisfactory life that we're in. You don't have to necessarily be in rebirth. You can also see it from moment to moment, kind of. It's ongoing kind of unsatisfactoriness that nothing in the world basically can give us any happiness. So often, you know, teachers don't really talk about this as much, about this awakening part. But I do think that, you know, hearing about it can, you know, really plant some seeds that might flourish at a later time, even if you have a feeling of like, oh, I'm not that interested in it right now. Like, you know, see. You never know. also really good to name that, you know, there's really nothing wrong with aiming for this higher quality samsara. You know, this is a really great way to use the Buddha's teachings. And the Buddha himself didn't force any awakening upon anyone. Oh, I forgot to put this on my chest, so the recording will probably not be great from what I said just now. So the Buddha didn't force any awakening upon anyone. Like, there's this example in the suttas where there's this king, and he visited the Buddha because he was overeating a lot, and he wanted to not overeat, basically. So he was like, Buddha, what can I do? And the Buddha said, like, well, you can chant recite this chant for every meal, and then it will help you to not overeat. So the king did that, and he stopped overeating, and the chant was about, you know, moderation in food and just using food to sustain your body, kind of, you know, thing. And so this king was just interested in this really practical application of the teachings, and he wasn't apparently not really interested in teachings about awakening, and the Buddha just said, okay, well, you can just do this. So he wasn't like forcing any awakenings teachings upon this king. But anyways, let's dive into this subject of awakening. An awakening is called Nibbana in Pali, and this description, you know, of Nibbana in the suttas is basically more about metaphors and describing what it's not than that there's, you know, real way to describe what Nibbana is. And some of the metaphors that I also named last time real quick were the island, the truth, the other shore, freedom, the unconditioned, the unfabricated, and also what is often named as the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion, the absence of all the roots of all of our unwholesomeness, basically. And so this full awakening is about being free, fully free from all of the unwholesomeness in our lives, free from this dukkha. And Nibbana itself is an experience. And the experience of Nibbana comes and goes until we're fully awakened. And on this path to full awakening, we'll go through four stages. And they are called the four stages of awakening. And I have to say, this is the Theravada view. So other Buddhist sects, how do you call it? Buddhist traditions? Yes, thank you. See that differently, I don't know. I haven't practiced in those traditions. So, and so there's this difference between the experience of Nibbana and going through those four stages of awakening. Each of the stages start with an experience of Nibbana and an insight, a deep insight into the nature of reality. But each stage always goes with at least a brief experience of Nibbana, or a longer one, depending on your conditioning. But this experience will go away until we're basically fully awakened. It can come back at any time, depending on conditions. We can have another experience of Nibbana. But each of those experiences, or each of those moments that we enter a new stage, comes with lasting changes in our lives. Even if you're not immersed in Nibbana the whole time, you still will be experiencing wholesome changes in your life. And so when we are fully awakened and then we pass away, then we will be entering Nibbana I don't know how, if you can say it like that, but forever, but it's probably not the right way to say it, but this is called Pari Nibbana. So Pari, kind of like after Nibbana, kind of the Nibbana that happens when we pass away, when we're fully awakened. And so these four stages successively offer more and more freedom freedom from what are called the asavas. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it really correctly, but asavas in Pali. And it, this is an interesting term. It's been translated in many different ways, but there's a description in the suttas. It says, asavas are states that defile, bring renewal of existence, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi, for example, translated as the taints. Sometimes they're translated as the effluence or the influxes, which is kind of interesting. It's about kind of a flow, kind of it means, literally it means something like a flow. So some people say it's an influx and some people say it's an effluent, like going in or out, a flow. And so, and so there are 10 asavas, which dissolve or go away as we move through those stages. And so the first stage is called the stream enter, sotapanna in Pali. And so that means like you have entered the stream and you can't go back anymore. So now you're bound for full awakening. You will be certain of full awakening after you've entered the stream. And there are 3 of those asavas or taints that are being erased at this stage. First one being the belief or experience of a self. That's also where this teaching on not self comes from. At this stage, we'll fully understand this not self aspect of the teaching. And you just kind of know that there's no separate entity that we can call self. It underlies these experiences that arise in body and mind. And the interesting thing is that the sense of self might still arise. There might still be a feeling of self, but one can then see clearly that's an illusion, that it's not real, that it can be seen as just an other experience that's happening instead of that it feels like a real thing. And then the second asava or taint is skeptical doubt. And so we might all have experienced this in our practice as one of the hindrances that, am I doing this practice right? Is this actually really good teaching? Or, you know, is the teacher saying the truth? Or that kind of doubts can arise. So it's a specific kind of doubt. It's not a doubt like, oh, should I get an ice cream today or not? It's really about the teachings and or the teacher or that kind of thing. And then so when the doubt has fallen away, then it's just really clear what the Buddha taught is correct and it will lead to liberation. That's kind of what you know, then it's kind of clear in that moment. And then the third asava, and the last that gets eradicated in this stage is the attachment to rites and rituals. So you will know that rites and rituals don't lead to awakening in itself. You might still perform rites or rituals, but you just know that that's not going to lead you to awakening. And there are examples in the suttas where people, for example, say like, oh, if I bathe in this river 100 times, then you know I'll be awakened. And then the Buddha says nope. That doesn't work like that. And then once you get to this stage, you actually know for yourself, oh yeah, that's not gonna work. And maybe in the West we're not as much into this whole ritual thing as maybe in Asia, I don't know. So it might not be a huge change for us, but for some people it might be more than for others. And so that's the first stage, the stream enter. And the suttas say that if you reach this stage, then you will experience a maximum of 7 more rebirths as a human. And you won't be able to be reborn as a lower being, like an animal or a Hungry Ghost or in the Hell Realms. Those are the lower realms of existence. I always just kind of name all of those things that are in the suttas just because it's there and it's also part of the teachings. You don't have to believe it, of course. And then one of the teachers I once worked with, Steve Armstrong, he says that a precondition for both this first stage is also the second stage is sila. Good ethical conduct is the precondition for attaining this stage. And of course, there's other conditions that need to be met. But if your sila is not in good order, then you're probably not going to attain the stage, according to what I heard from Steve. And so the second stage, once you reach that stage, you're called a once returner. That is because you'll be born at most one more time as a human being. So, but the thing is that no asavas are eradicated during this stage. It's just that this sense desire, ill will, and ignorance become weakened, more and more weakened. So it might not be like a huge, not as huge of a shift as during the first stage. It will be more of a weakening of those unwholesome states of mind. And then the third stage, is called the non-returner. The second stage is Sakadagami, I think, and third stage Anagami, non-returner. And that is because you will not be reborn again as a human being, and you have at most one more life as a heavenly being. After, if you die as a non-returner, you'll be going to heaven and spend your time there. So it's pretty relaxed and pleasant abiding, as I've understood from the suttas. But here, there will be some asavas eradicated. The asava of sense desire and ill will be eradicated. The desire for immaterial rebirth does remain, though. So that's the only desire that remains. Immaterial rebirth means being reborn as a heavenly being, so that way you can still, you know, that's why you're getting this rebirth as a heavenly being. And so this desire and ill will are the two of the three roots of unwholesomeness, right? So we had desire or craving, aversion, ill will, and ignorance. Ignorance is only being eradicated at the last stage. And so this is a very deep step, because you know, you have no sense desire, no craving anymore, no ill will, aversion, anxiety, anger. So you there's a lot of peace then, and you're truly like a safe haven for other beings as well as for yourself. This is deep eradication. Yeah. Not that's a different tradition. So a bodhisattva in Mahayana tradition is someone who vows. There are bodhisattvas in Theravada who vows to become a Buddha and to first liberate all other beings before being liberated themselves fully. And so there are people in Theravada tradition who vow that, but it's in Mahayana is kind of this basic thing that you almost have to do to be on the path of Buddhism. And in Theravada, that's not at all necessary. So you can just get fully enlightened as much as you like. You don't have to first liberate all other beings. But the thing is that to become a Buddha, it's very difficult to become a Buddha because you have to perfect all the 10 paramis, for example. Well, for us, if we don't have this wish to become a Buddha, and then we can just perfect them in or work with the perfections or the 10 paramis to the extent needed for our liberation, and not we don't have to like go through this very long journey of perfecting them. Yeah, did you want to say something, George? And so according to Steve Armstrong, a prerequisite for attaining this stage is concentration. So one thing that arose for me hearing that is that, for example, Upandita is a Burmese monk. He passed away in the last century, but he only taught concentration practice to people who had already attained the first stage of awakening. So attaining the first stage of awakening, we might not need like jhana or deep concentration states. But if we want to proceed on the path through the third or the fourth stage, we might actually need some jhana practice. But apparently when you attain the first stage, it becomes easier to attain jhana. So if you're feeling like, you know, some people have this wish to attain jhana, which is very deep absorption, and they have a lot of trouble attaining it. Because it's just, you know, it does require for most people kind of this longer stretch of time to practice, and then even, you know, for some people it just takes a lot and a lot of practice. And so you can be encouraged that, you know, it might not be needed. There's some level of concentration needed, but maybe not jhana for the first stage. And then once you attain the first stage, you might start some jhana practice to proceed on the path, and then it might be a little easier for you to get there. So just a thought. And so the fourth stage. So when you are you've reached the fourth stage, you're called an arahat, and it's often not even translated in English. And I forgot to look up the translation. Oh, I did look up the translation. I think it means the perfect one. So no rebirth anymore, you're done, you know, all asavas have been eradicated, so also the ignorance, which was one of the last ones, and also the desire for the immaterial rebirth. And then also arrogance or mana in Pali is being eradicated, and this means kind of this comparing we do, it's comparing minds, comparing ourselves to others, and we often think like, oh, as long as I feel equal to others, you know, then I'm good. But the Buddha says nope, it's not about being less or more or equal, neither of those. It's about not comparing yourself, but that only is fully eradicated at the last stage. And the mana is also about this feeling of I am. So the interesting thing is that this notion of self disappears at the first stage, but this feeling of I am is still there. So it's something different. Those are two different things. And the difference is that this I am is kind of this statement of, or this feeling of I am, and the self is about I am this, like I am this body, I am this perception, I am this feeling. Yeah, so that's kind of the difference as I've understood it. And then also another asava that's being eradicated is restlessness. And we probably all know restlessness is one of the hindrances as well. Like, oh, it's this antsy feeling of can't really sit still, or this feeling of lots of thoughts, or yeah, that kind of thing. But there are some documents where arahats have described their experience, and what they've described is that it's a very subtle form of restlessness that is being eradicated here. It's not at all this kind of gross restlessness of like, oh, I can't sit still kind of thing. So yeah, I'm not sure. I can't imagine what a very subtle restlessness, what they feel or how they, but that's how they described it as very subtle. And so only when we've attained arhatship will we truly be able to see things as they really are. And we're getting a better sense with each step, but only at arhatship we'll fully see the whole picture. Because until that point, our view will be, or our experience is colored by ignorance. Ignorance stays there. And there might be little moments that ignorance might fall away. But there might be, I don't know, maybe there's always just a little bit of ignorance in the background, because else we'd be arahats, maybe.
It's high quality ignorance.
High quality ignorance, yes. Exactly. Yeah, so this is the third noble truth, freedom from all this whole heap of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness is possible. And we're all on this sloping ocean floor towards this reef, and then maybe the second and the third and the fourth reef. And so, yeah, it's not that often talked about, but that makes kind of sense, because, how practical is this for our daily lives, right? Usually people talk about what's practical for this moment right now. But I think that hearing this goal of the Buddha's teachings can be very inspiring for some people, and it's worthwhile to talk about it every once in a while, just to, maybe spark something in someone. And it's fine if it doesn't spark anything. That's also fine. And then for some people, it's like, is this really like true? Is this really possible? And Jack Kornfield is actually someone who has been pretty open about it. And other people also, like Deepa Ma, I don't know if you know her. She was an Indian lay person who is kind of the teacher of Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and others. And there's a book written about her, and there's a lot of stuff in there around awakening and just people telling about their own awakening, and like her daughter talking about attaining the first stage, and Deepa Ma herself is said to attain the third stage of awakening. So yeah, those are all very encouraging stories, I think. And then there's another book by Mei Chi Kao, which is a Thai, I think she was a nun, Thai nun, who attained awakening. So those are all really interesting books to look up if you're interested in this subject. And also Jack Kornfield, he describes a little bit in A Path with Heart, his book A Path with Heart. He describes a little bit about it as well. And I have a bit of a quote here, but it's already pretty late. Let me look at this. I'll skip that. I'll end with the Buddha. He says, "If it were not possible to free the heart from entanglement, I would not teach you to do so. Just because it is possible to free the heart, there arises the teachings of the Dhamma of liberation, offered open-handedly for the welfare of all beings."